My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/MPN to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/MPN. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Mike Carlin hosts a great podcast called Uncorking a Story. Mike, tell us what these fine folks will get when they listen.
Uncorking a Story profiles successful writers and authors to uncover how their background and life experiences influence the stories they create. We learn what motivates them, their path to success, and what fuels them to keep creating. And it all starts by asking one simple question. Where does your story begin?
Ooh, interesting. Where can people subscribe?
You can follow the show at uncorkingstory.com, at marketingpodcast.net, or by searching for Uncorking a Story wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard him. Go subscribe.
I'm Nick Westergaard, and this is On Brand, helping you tell your story. My guest this week is Carla Johnson.
Being able to break down where you get inspiration from ideas and how you connect that into the work that you do to come up with a great idea and then tell the story of that idea through your pitch is something that everybody at every level in every organization can do.
As the world's leading innovation architect, Carla Johnson has partnered with brands and conferences globally to train thousands of people how to rethink the work that they do and the impact that they can have. Through her company, Rethink Labs, she inspires and equips leaders to embrace change, welcome new ideas, and make innovation everybody's business. Carla, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you, Nick. It's so great to be here. I appreciate you having me.
You know, I love that charge at the end about making innovation everybody's business. And I think that's a good way to put it, because I feel like sometimes innovation is sort of treated like a special word in a black box that only certain people in an organization have the qualifications to approach. But why should it be everybody's business?
You know, it's you're right, Nick. It's something. It's a special word for special people with special qualifications and special titles and oftentimes special privileges. But when you look at what makes innovation successful in organizations, it's not that it's necessarily only a skill. I mean, there definitely is a skill component, but it's more of a mindset. And mindsets shouldn't have parameters on them. It's not something that a certain person thinks and another one doesn't. And in fact, it was interesting when I was doing research for my book, Rethink Innovation, I came across this statistic that said 90% of innovation actually takes place outside of a traditional innovation group. And then there's research that came out from Accenture last year that put empirical evidence behind all of this that showed that the organizations that unleashed innovation and infused it across the organization, they had greater revenues, greater success, a greater ability to respond to market conditions and customer changing expectations, which we know we've all seen, you know, an unimaginable amount. I'm really looking for another word to replace unprecedented, level in these last couple of years. And that's really where innovation comes in. And if we think that innovation is only about the product and services that we sell, then we're missing that other 90% opportunity as brands.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned in there your recent book, Rethink Innovation. And I think because of
all of these reasons, all of the, yeah, unprecedented. I feel like we've overused it, but it still fits in some circumstances. So we just have to take a deep breath and say it for the millionth time. But rethink innovation for all the reasons that you've mentioned. We desperately need a manual on innovation to help us access the black box skill or the special word to make it more of a process. But I have to imagine that in writing a book about innovation, that in and of itself was a challenging process.
It was, because when you think of the word innovation, it's a big thing, right? You ask 20 different people to even define innovation and you'll get 40 or 50 different definitions with some corollaries, appendices, and, you know, and certain conditions and asterisks applied. You know, it's a big thing for people to get their arms around. It's something that I think historically we've made very complex. We've made time consuming. We've made elitist, because if innovation is something that's super simple, then we don't need to pay millions of dollars for consultants to come in and help us out, right? And I think that's one of those things about innovation is that it's been a practice and a mindset that historically has had this shroud of mystery and elitism around it, because consultants can charge a lot of money for it in that way. But what makes innovation successful and approachable is simplifying it. But as you know, with a lot of things, simple isn't easy.
No.
And it takes a lot of work to break it down. And that was really a big motivator I had behind my reasons of writing the book, Rethink Innovation, is that, and I'm sure you have this list of people also, Nick, that you look at and you think, how can they consistently just over and over and over again come up with these amazing ideas that they execute and it works every single time, whether it's a person or a team that you watch or a brand. And so my quest was to set out and answer the question, is the ability to consistently come up with great ideas something that can be replicated? And the answer is yes, which is why you have the book in your hands. But it's looking at what is the process that people follow and where do they get inspiration for these ideas. And it was interesting, as I interviewed people, I would say, like, where did you get the inspiration for that idea? And like most people, they're like, I don't know. You know, it came to me on my run, came to me in the shower. You know, it just popped into my head. So then I would ask them a series of questions and kind of reverse engineer it into, well, you know, when you had this idea, where were you? Like, were you in a team meeting? Were you on a run? Were you in the shower? You know, sometimes I don't need all the details. And then like, what happened before that? And, you know, what were you doing before that? And reverse engineer it. And in every single case, they could lead it to something they experienced that made an impression on them or was something they were passionate about. And then they connected the dots and understood how to bring that into the work. But the interesting thing is, most of the time, they didn't even realize that's what they were doing. But when I went back to each of them and said, you know, here's what I'm seeing and hearing as a consistent process, and I explained the process to them, they all said, well, that's exactly what I did. I just didn't realize it. And I think being able to break down where you get inspiration from ideas and how you connect that into the work that you do to come up with a great idea and then tell the story of that idea through your pitch is something that everybody at every level in every organization can do.
That is, you know, from the whole spectrum, and the book covers that from everything about idea generation into the pitch. But when you were talking about simple is hard, it made me think of along the way when you talk about the practice of innovation and idea generation, you've got some great mindset cues and idea starters in there. I particularly like the idea of thinking like a child, because I feel like whenever you say simple is hard, I always think there's so many things that can be said about, from innovation to communication. And the child touch point reminds me of just that we didn't used to suck at this. As grown-ups, we're creatures of complexity.
That's right.
So talk a bit about why that child's mindset is helpful to us.
And you think about as adults, if I said to you, Nick, let's play hooky today. Your first thought is, I can't because I got to reschedule this podcast with Carla. I've got, you know, all these things too. I it can't be done. Today's not the day. Let's schedule a day for me to play hooky. You've added complexity into it because you put all of these parameters and requirements and adultisms on top of how you think. But if you said to a five-year-old, let's play hooky today, they're like, all right, let's go to the park, let's get ice cream, let's go to grandma's house. And there was actually research that was done by this. I think it was from a group in North Dakota. I don't want to be 100% on that because I can't remember exactly, but they did a research study with two groups of people. And with the first one, they said, you have the day off. How do you spend the day? And they said things like, well, I'd go pick up the dry cleaning. I'd catch up on my taxes. I'd try to get that email inbox, you know, manageable. They essentially made a list of very adult things that they would do that would, you know, assumably make their life easier. But then with the second group, they said, okay, you have today off. What would you do? And oh, by the way, pretend you're 7 years old. And the lists were entirely different. It was things like, I'm going to the park. I'm eating as much ice cream as I can. I'm going to go hang out at my grandma's house. You know, it was all very fun and playful and lighthearted things. So between the time we're 7 and 37 or 47 or, you know, whatever age as an adult, we've had that sense of playfulness taught out of us as essentially irresponsible. So you go through school and you're taught, well, it's great to play, but first do all of your homework. And not just do all of your homework, like don't have any fun doing your homework. I know that's how I was raised. Like homework, mm-hmm. Emphasis on the work. You know, you can't have fun at work. So we're taught that homework has to be dull, dry, a drudgery. It's not fun. We go from that into university and, you know, other than spring break and some late nights, you know, here and there. Essentially, the message is you need to put in your time. And then you get out and you get into work. Well, they sure aren't going to say have fun and play, right? And the whole evaluation and reward process of much of education and then our careers has nothing to do with fun. And we've been rewarded into that kind of behavior because that's how people behave based on how they're rewarded. And so then all of a sudden, here come these people out of left field who don't follow any of those rules, and they are playful. They remember what it was like to be 7 years old, and they do all these things. And then they're lauded as these amazing innovators, creative thinkers, and it really feels unfair because for everybody else, we've followed this process, and we've done what we've been told and taught, and we're in these work environments that tell us how to behave. And so here are these innovative creative thinkers, and now they get the special jobs, they get the special titles, they get a special way to dress, they get special projects to work on. And so it really does create an us and them, and a I know how and you don't kind of mentality around innovation. And it's somehow become this thing that most people say, either I don't know how to do, which if you go back to our childhood, we're very innate at this, or I'm not smart enough to do because I don't have whatever qualifications that group that sits at that table has. And so I'm just not even going to try.
You know, I think that we have some background similarities that we've talked about before. Definitely raised with the homework first and then fun. And And I've ended up with as a grown-up that values that. And I know over the aforementioned challenging past couple of years, you know, when you don't really go a lot of places and your days look the same, you make these work lists that you're plowing through. And I actually had a coach that I was talking about with about burnout. And they, you know, looked at these lists I was making and they said, why don't you schedule the fun things and add those in as well? You know, draw, read, lay in the hammock, do some of these other things that, you know, it's been really helpful to me and my process, but I had to treat it like I was giving, like I was the unfun stuff and making sure that I slotted it in because otherwise we don't seem to value it.
And that's so true. And I think also it can be dependent on the culture in where you were raised. So you and I grew up in small town Nebraska, a town of 1,000 people. You're from Iowa.
Yep.
I think are the cultures in which we grew up and were very much about an honor and a hard work ethic. And one of the things that was so eye-opening for me is this was right before the pandemic. My husband and I and our three teenage kids, we moved to Spain for a year because it was always a dream that my husband and I had was to live abroad with our kids. And we didn't work for companies that would transfer us. So we just picked up and moved. And my husband took a year off of work and he was Mr. Mom and the kids took classes online. Who knew how that was prepping them for life when they came back, you know? And then I just worked from there. And an interesting thing was one of the things that I did is that I taught at a university in Barcelona in their digital marketing program. And I remember one day going into a conference room and saying, can I eat my lunch in here? And they all kind of looked at me like, well, you could, but why would you want to? You know, Spain is the culture of where you take time off. You know, it's a 2-hour lunch that you spend with friends and you leave your work and it's very social and there's very much a boundaries and balance between work and enjoying life and taking time to slow down and really savor what you do every day. And by the time we were done with that year, I'll be honest, it was very hard to come back to the US. And it was a time that changed how I looked at how I worked and how much I worked and what that work looked like. And I did make some changes that I feel made more space for exploration and creative trial and error and doing things that I felt had the potential to be innovative. But even if I, you know, didn't know how it was going to turn out, I was willing to give it a try. And I think try more things. And even one just little example is I live in Colorado, one of the greatest places to ski and snowboard in the world. And sometimes Wednesdays have a great powder day. And if I don't have much on my schedule, and if I, you know, of course I don't go on Fridays because that's when I talk to Nick Westergaard, but you know, so if I can rejigger some things and go snowboarding on Wednesday and work on Saturday, or maybe, you know, adjust however it works, you know, that's taking advantage of what you do as a kid. If it's a sunny, beautiful day outside, you go outside and play. And then, you know, you do the work later, you make accommodations. And I think that's, we put parameters on ourselves about what work should look like and when we should do it and all of these things. And I think one of the lessons that I've learned is the more I give myself permission to have time, to make that time. And like you said, Nick, sometimes it's a matter of scheduling in the downtime or the creative things, just like you do the things we know we need to do. I don't want to imply that those things don't ever need to be done, but I think we can rethink what they look like and when and how they get done. That can actually make us much more creative and happier and better at them.
On Brand, we'll be right back after this.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure. I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/MPN to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/MPN. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Mike Carlin hosts a great podcast called Uncorking a Story. Mike, tell us what these fine folks will get when they listen.
Uncorking a Story profiles successful writers and authors to uncover how their background and life experiences influence the stories they create. We learn what motivates them, their path to success, and what fuels them to keep creating. And it all starts by asking one simple question. Where does your story begin?
Ooh, interesting. Where can people subscribe?
You can follow the show at uncorkingstory.com, at marketingpodcast.net, or by searching for Uncorking a Story wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard him. Go subscribe.
Now, back to the show. So all of this adds up to greater space for innovation then? Is that what, when you cultivate a mindset and practice like this, is that how we connect it to the work of innovation?
I think it's understanding that there's parts of the process, of the five-step process, and we can get into that in a minute, that do require a little more space. And if you've ever been in a situation where you need to come up with a great idea under pressure, and you don't have the skills to do that, it can be tough. It's no different from somebody saying to you, all right, Nick, we're going to run a 5K, but we're going to do it right now. And I know you don't know how, and I know you don't have the skills, and I know you haven't trained, but here's the ultimate performance metric I expect you to hit. Now, how awesome do you feel about hitting that performance metric if you haven't had any practice? You haven't had any time to develop your skills. You haven't had any space on your own to figure out what works for you to deliver that performance. How confident are you in the ability to, you know, deliver that expected level of performance? For most people, they're like, no, I'm not doing that. You know, I need more time. I need all these things. Yet we don't give that same mindset and approach to creative thinking or developing innovative ideas. But the more that you practice, so if you were someone who ran every day and you didn't just run, but you did sprints and drills and you read about nutrition and associated with other runners and athletes, and I came to you and I said, all right, Nick, we're going to go out and we're going to run a 5K. You'd be much more likely to have confidence in your performance, right? Well, the same thing is true when it comes to ideas. If you ask somebody who's not skilled, who's not practiced, who's not familiar to hit an expected level of performance, of course they're going to struggle. Yet that's what happens every single day in teams, in, you know, from leaders to employees or even employees on themselves. And then they don't perform at that level, so they think they're a failure. Now, if it was us in that 5K situation and I said, Nick, I expect you to run this 5K in 18 minutes and you didn't hit it, well, you go, well, of course I didn't. I didn't know what to do. I hadn't trained. I hadn't done all these things. Yet when it comes to ideas and creative and critical thinking, we just think we're awful at it. And so we quit and we say, well, that's something somebody else does. And we have a different set of standards and expectations when it comes to innovation than we do how we look at skills in any other area of our life.
So speaking of those standards, you alluded to your framework earlier. Walk us through that.
Absolutely. And I found this pretty interesting. And I'll go through the five steps and then talk about them just a little bit more and explain them. So the five-step process is what I call my perpetual innovation process, because when I looked at the people I researched and interviewed for the book, I understood that when they followed this process, they perpetually innovated over long periods of time. And the five steps are to observe, distill, relate, generate, and pitch. And we start out with the observe step. And this is something that I think, especially as we get busy or under pressure, we don't do. But one of my favorite things is to sit in a mall, inside or outside, and just people watch. And it's fascinating because you look at how people dress differently, how they walk differently, how groups interact differently. You know, last night my husband and I went to Lowe's and we watched this sweet couple, I would say late 70s, early 80s in front of us, and how they interacted. Now that was very different from the four high school guys I saw at the gym earlier in the day. Neither's right or wrong. It's just observing the nuances and the differences of, you know, how people interact. And sometimes it's one of the quirky things I observed is I'm lucky enough to travel a lot for my work, is looking at the different icons that are used on the walk symbols in, you know, in cities around the world. And it's all these little things that we start to do. And this is very natural and something genetically we've always done as humans, is that we observe the world around us, because that gives us clues that lead to the second step in distilling those observations into patterns. When we observe things that we see, it's like, it gives us clues. Is the pattern that we're safe? Is the pattern that it's a relaxed atmosphere? Is the pattern that I need to be quiet and sit up straight and mind my P's and Q's? You know, what is it that we're observing that shows us a pattern? Sometimes the pattern is about community. Sometimes it's about conversation. Sometimes it's about structure, whatever that may be. And then that leads us to the third step, which is relate. After we start to see these things that we've observed and distill them into patterns, how do we start to relate those patterns into the work that we do every day? So if we're looking at, for instance, during the pandemic, one of the things that we would observed is that people weren't physically together. So what were some of the patterns that we started to see? People were overworked. People felt disconnected. People were hungry for a human connection. People wanted something that, you know, helped us remember that we weren't supposed to just work 10, 12, 16 hours a day, day after day. You know, we wanted some sense of originality, something that was different. And so if we look at that, when we go to the fourth step, which is generate, how do we start to generate ideas that respond to that? You know, this is one of those examples about the llama farm that used to have people come to their farm to see the animals, that they understood this, what they had observed and the patterns they distilled and how it related into their work. The idea that they generated was, you know what, instead of people coming to us, maybe we bring our animals to the people. And that's how they came up with the idea of rent a llama. And you could have a llama show up on your Zoom call. Now, you know, that breaks all the expectations. It's completely different. It's very original. And so then when they went to pitch that idea, I don't know that this is what they did because I haven't talked to the people. But if you go back and you simply tell the story of what you observed, the patterns that you distill, how that relates to your work, and that was the inspiration behind the idea that you have, you now have a built-in pitch just based on what you already went through. And the reason that pitch becomes so much more likely to get approval is because, one, you've given people context for where the idea came from. Two, you've taken them on a journey of the idea that they can now understand and feel a part of. Three, you've connected the dots between something that was inspirational and the idea that you actually generated. And then four, you're asking people for their feedback, and people are more likely to support something that they're a part of. But what typically happens when people want a new idea or need a new idea is that they don't start until step four, and they say, we need ideas. We need to get together on a Zoom call in a conference room. We need to generate as many ideas as we possibly can. And you know what they say, Nick, come on, give us all your ideas. There's no such thing as a bad idea. You know that most of the ideas are awful ideas. So then they go to pitch them. and their boss or their client says, no, we're not that kind of company. We don't have that kind of budget. Nobody likes llamas. And you end up going back and doing the same thing that you've always done. And it takes it sucks the soul out of people. And then they say, well, they're, you know, you're right. We're not that kind of company. I'm not that kind of person. I guess I'll just leave it to the innovation team. And we miss all these opportunities to have big impact, even if it's in small incremental ways.
Well, that is a great overview. And I love that you brought it back full circle to that idea of innovation being everybody's business. Carla, throughout the book, you talk about lots of innovative brands. And I can't say enough good things about it. But I want to ask you, as we start to wrap up here, for a brand that has made you smile recently.
You know, this is one of my favorite brands, and I do profile them pretty deeply in the book. And it's Emerson. They're an industrial manufacturing company in St. Louis, Missouri. And the reason I keep going back to them is because they consistently surprise me. And their whole process of how they have adopted innovation across the organization is one that is very rare to see. And they make it not only something that they talk about externally and not just something that they say, oh, innovation is a value. They actually have put into place performance reviews that say, in order to get to the type of innovation that we value as an organization, here are the behaviors that we give employees feedback on their employee reviews. So it's very clear what innovation looks like in their company, how they expect employees to behave in order to deliver that. They're very transparent about what it looks like. They are phenomenal at celebrating people at all levels across the organization that exhibit these behaviors. And I think that's one thing that's missing a lot in organizations is understanding you have to be very clear about how you define innovation. And then let's make sure that we consistently tell stories of what that looks like in our company. So people don't think that it only has to be what this innovation or R&D group or, you know, however you have it, you know, that they're the only ones who innovate. And when I look at how they've been able to evolve their story of innovation over the last 20, 25 years that I've followed them, I now see campaigns coming out from them that have, like, you never ever see the product, but you see the impact on people, individual people, and oftentimes consumers, of what happens because of the innovation that they've delivered as a brand. And watching how a company is able to shift a culture and move the ownership of great ideas from a particular group or a particular, you know, level of an organization like leadership and really consistently infuse it and make innovation everybody's business. It's a case study in how this is something that when you consistently practice it, study it, reward it, train people on how to do it, you have incredible outcomes, these extraordinary outcomes that you wouldn't necessarily ever use as a business objective from the get-go that you absolutely can realize.
That is a great brand and makes me smile just hearing about it. Carla, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
The best place is my website. It's carlajohnson.co. There's no M. I always say it's .co for the great state of Colorado. And once you're there, you can sign up for my newsletter where I share many tools, tricks, tips, and case studies about how to infuse innovation, creative thinking in your own work or on your team. I always love it when people connect with me on LinkedIn and let me know that they heard me on Nick's podcast and what you thought of the episode. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Carla Johnson.
Awesome. And we will link up to all of that in our show notes at onbrandpodcast.com. Carla, thanks for being on brand with us.
Thank you, Nick. It was a delight to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
On Brand is part of the Marketing Podcast Network. If you like what you're hearing, if we've made you smile, you can always listen free on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your favorite platform may be. And please take a moment and rate and review the podcast to help others find the show. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Mike Carlin hosts a great podcast called Uncorking a Story. Mike, tell us what these fine folks will get when they listen.
Uncorking a Story profiles successful writers and authors to uncover how their background and life experiences influence the stories they create. We learn what motivates them, their path to success, and what fuels them to keep creating. And it all starts by asking one simple question. Where does your story begin?
Ooh, interesting. Where can people subscribe?
You can follow the show at uncorkingstory.com, at marketingpodcast.net, or by searching for Uncorking a Story wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard him. Go subscribe.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.